proto fish people.
Yeah, the proto fish people. Yeah. Hello, our valued listeners. Welcome back to another fun-filled, action-packed episode of Conspiranormal with me, your co-host, Luke.
And your host, Adam. All right, and we're back. It's been like a month.
Yeah.
Kind of took a little break from Conspiranormal for a little while.
All right.
Just to kind of rest up a little bit and... Some momentous changes in your life. Got yourself a job.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing.
Well, I've had a job this whole time, dude.
Well, that's true.
But
you got yourself, like, what one would consider, like, a real job.
A better job, you know.
Yeah.
But it's the most money I've ever made in my life, but it's really not, like, an extremely large amount.
But your plan is to still live in your car.
Yeah, I'm gonna stay in my car, and I'm gonna use all that income to buy boats and four wheelers, and
you could have a whole fleet you could sleep in.
Awesome stuff. Yeah, I mean, you know, what better way to save money? I don't really need a house.
Yeah,
it's convenient. Yeah, but
well, our last episode was with Adam Ellenboss, and I know you probably have a little bit of things if you can remember that far back, like stuff that. You know, you really enjoyed that interview. You were talking about it for days.
Yeah.
As if you got any kind of, like, insight into that.
Yeah. You know, so, obviously, it'd be a little hard for me to get a hold of some ayahuasca, so I started doing a little meditating and all that. And, you know, because Adam was talking about how he had faced his demons and stuff, just like all the other ayahuasca users, and I was like, you know, I wonder if I could get to the bottom of what's holding me back in life, you know?
Yeah.
And look at the entities responsible, and I did, you know, and I see them, and I see it for what it's worth now. And good news is I slowed down on the drinking. I only drink like once a week now. And
well, that's good.
Still a sex addict, but that's not going to change anytime soon.
Yeah, probably not. Well, I had heard some interesting things last week, you know, 4 weeks or so that we've been gone. One of the interesting things is that two of the FBI agents that were helping to arrest the Zokhar Tsarnaev, that's the brother that was arrested for mm-hmm. the Boston bombing and the Boston Marathon, two of those FBI agents have died in a training exercise.
Oh, yeah.
So, I don't know.
How convenient.
That was possibly real interesting.
Yeah.
At first, I was kind of thinking maybe those were the guys, because of my theory about that it was the FBI that was probably going to set it, was helping to set it up, and then we're going to sweep in at the last minute and save everybody. And somehow that got screwed up. And one of the things that happened was I've just felt like that was probably... you're probably going to see somebody resign or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I first heard that news, I thought possibly that, you know, those were the guys that possibly screwed it up.
Yeah.
And that they were dead.
Well, it's a lot easier to just kill someone that knows something rather
yeah,
than...
Yeah, possibly. But a lot of other news sources were saying that it was, you know, there was just somebody that helped to arrest those two guys. And then, but it could just have been a coincidence. I don't know.
Yeah. It's still pretty weird, though. I mean,
yeah.
that's a highly... it's just a strange coincidence.
Right.
It doesn't... That's the same deal with, you know, the SEAL Team 6 getting shot down in the helicopter,
mm-hmm.
like, a week later.
Most of the people that were in the Bin Laden raid that got shot down, like, 2-3 weeks later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
I think it's more like a month.
And it was a lot less televised, you know? It's just like a
yep.
little side story.
Yep. One of the things I wanted to talk about before we go to our guests, and this is kind of just real quick, this is kind of like a work thing for me, but I kind of thought it fit in a little bit with the show. At my job and Luke's former job, we make screens, like big digital picture frames. So we use sources like televisions and such, LED, LCD televisions. And we were ordering from a large chain store that I will remain nameless. And we had purchased three, and then the same day went and purchased one more. Because we purchased four in a day, they canceled the order on us. They restricted what we could buy and what we couldn't. That's not exactly the free market, I would say, right?
Well, I mean,
it's more like something like...
That could just be a quantity issue, though, with them. I mean...
It wasn't a quantity issue. It wasn't that they didn't have it. It's that they... Which is what we thought at first. It was because they had plenty of it. They had plenty of this particular model.
Yeah.
But it was because we were just restricted because we had ordered too many in one day.
How would that possibly be any threat to any kind of agency whatsoever, though?
Right.
That's what I don't understand.
Well, as far as you saying, like, what I'm saying about it?
Yeah.
Well, I'm just saying that it's not exactly like we talk about, in this country, about the free market and all that kind of jazz. And you just see that these companies just pretty much control and do whatever they want.
Yeah, that's true.
It's not exactly, people are out there that are naive and say, oh, we got the free market and all that stuff. And it's not true.
Yeah.
It's kind of like East Germany. You're restricting what you can buy.
Right.
And then they put a flag on the credit card, and then we tried to order some more thinking it was all solved. And then they canceled the orders again. And told us, well, since you're a reseller, you've been flagged as a reseller. Which, if anybody's in business, you're a reseller, you're buying something to resell.
Yeah.
And they told me today that you cannot resell because they wouldn't be able to honor their warranty. And I said, well, we don't care about that because we have our own warranty. We're going to take care of that. And when I said that, they hung up on me. So, that's the kind of good American business that you get.
Oh, wow. Awesome.
But anyway, enough of my sob story. Tonight we have Nick Redfern. We're going to talk about a book that he wrote a couple years ago called Final Events. It is the secret government group on demonic UFOs and the afterlife. And this is a book that I read about 2 years ago. Actually, I heard Nick on Future Quake talking about it. Nick is normally just talks about UFOs, cryptozoology. He's kind of a jack of all trades in the paranormal world. And the guy's written like 25-something books. So we're going to go to him, and we'll come back on the other side on Conspiranormal. All right, we're back on Conspiranormal. It's your host, Adam Sane.
Co-host, still the same guy.
Yep, Luke Reed. All right, on the line we have Nick Redfern, and he wrote a book, one of his many books, a few years ago called Final Events, and I just wanted to bring Nick on to talk about that. Should be a very interesting interview. There's a lot of ground to cover in it because it is an extremely compelling book. Nick, we want to welcome you to Conspiranormal.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. Sure. Nick, for our audience that is not familiar with you, but I think in the paranormal field probably that not too many people are not familiar with you, could you just kind of go over who you are and we'll just kind of take it as it comes?
Yeah, sure. Well, originally from England, lived just outside Dallas in Texas. I work as a writer, sort of journalist, author, lecturer, things like that. And my background, when I first left school, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I wasn't the best student, just about to scrape through high school, and that was about it. But I got a job offer working on a rock music magazine back in England called Zero, which isn't around anymore, and I did that for a couple of years, and it got me interested in the world of journalism and writing. And I actually had an interest in paranormal stuff because my dad was in the British Royal Air Force and worked on radar. And, he was involved in a couple of UFO incidents where these fast-moving, high-flying targets were tracked on the radar scopes. Nobody knew what they were, and everybody was told not to talk about it. And my dad didn't until I was, like, 13 or 14, and that's what got me interested in that. And so what I did was to sort of combine the interest in UFOs and things like that with the couple of years I'd done working on the magazine and thought, well, you know, why not try and combine the two and sort of apply investigative journalistic techniques but to phenomena like UFOs and Bigfoot or whatever. So that's basically what I've, you know, what I've done since then is to sort of, you know, dig into the areas like that that interest me and write about the experiences and the files or the that I've uncovered or the witnesses I've interviewed, that kind of thing.
Yeah, you are quite prolific. I've seen some internet memes out there that says that you write a book. Like, as you read this, Nick Redfern has written a book.
Well, yeah, somebody else made a joke that I've got like seven clones or something all sitting around, you know, typing. Well, I cracked the whip, you know, kind of thing. But now, I mean, basically, I mean, some writers, you know, they like to sort of burn the midnight oil. I mean, I like to stay up late, you know. I don't want to turn in much before about one. But I like to keep regular hours. So what I like working hours. So I like to work Monday to Friday, 8 to 5. And when you're doing that sort of, you know, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, you can sort of crank out a lot of work, you know. It's not... When you think of like a 70, 80,000 word book, if you've got all the dates and the information and the interviews done, you know, if you can do 8 hours a day every day or 5 days a week for like 4 months, you know, you can get a book written quite easily in that time, really.
Yeah, it's pretty much like that's your full time. It's a full time gig for you. You don't have any other kind of job that you have to worry about.
Well, not so much other jobs, but I mean, I don't earn a living from writing books. I mean, people think if you write books, you know, you're driving around in a Ferrari or something, you know what I mean? It's not quite like that at all. But I work full-time as a writer, but I mean, a lot of what I do is, you know, I don't do anything paranormal at all. I mean, the most recent, I mean, just to give you an example, nothing to do with the paranormal, one article I was commissioned to do the other day was an article on whether it's safe and okay to lay asphalt when it's raining. So I do a lot of stuff for companies that sort of research stuff and how-to guides for people, you know, to do everything from how to, you know, trim the hair on a Labrador or whatever, you know, or to lay an asphalt, you know. So it isn't all sort of you know, excitement and X-Files stuff by any means. But I work full-time as a writer, but like most writers will know, you know, it's a job that I love doing, but, you know, you're never going to sort of retire at 35 and, you know, be sitting by the pool with a Lamborghini in the drive.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm not bothered about that. I want a job I enjoy, you know.
Yeah, it's a passion.
Yeah, exactly.
I wanted to get into about Final Events, and this is a book that, you know, I myself was aware of the works of guys like Guy Malone, Elia Marzulli, Joe Jordan. I was actually aware of those guys before I read your book. And, you know, I kind of had felt like Joe Jordan was maybe the kind of the first in the 90s to make a link between the demonic and alien abductions. But that really, as your book proves, turns out not to be true, because you talk about an organization called the Collins Elite. And which is a very strange name. I'm sure we'll get into the etymology of that. But it's something that starts with a guy named Ray Boucher in the early 90s.
Well, basically, you know, sometimes when you're doing investigation, you stumble across a story and you find it yourself, you know. Other times, witnesses will come to you and say, hey, I wanted to share this with you, and then when they give the information, a few names, that leads to other things. Well, the story behind Final Events was sort of a completely different thing. Over the years, I've had sort of periodic, occasional contact with a man named Ray Boucher. And Ray's a former state director for MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network. And he was back in the 80s a state director for Nebraska, where he lives. And Ray is also a priest, an Anglican priest. And so his background, the more he looked into the UFO subject, Ray came to sort of draw parallels between UFO activity and certain sort of paranormal or, you know, supernatural or demonic activity even. And, you know, came to view the, Ray came to view the whole alien abduction, or even the alien presence, if you like, as being like a deception to mask the idea that these entities are literally demonic, you know, literally sort of heaven and hell demonic, that kind of thing.
Sure.
And Ray wrote about this. He did a number of papers in the early 1990s and late 80s that talked about some of the parallels between the experiences that people would have in the UFO field and also the paranormal field, and things like negative backlash and ill health and these entities kind of acting like a predatory fashion. And when, on one occasion when I was speaking to Ray, he related this story to me about how in 1991 he was approached by two physicists working on a classified Department of Defense program. And it was basically the two guys approached Ray because they wanted the opinion and perspective of someone who, number one, was heavily involved in the UFO field, but number two, also had a background and a deep knowledge of Christianity. And Ray said, well, sure, you know, he was intrigued by the fact that not somebody just wanted to speak to him, but it was two physicists from the Pentagon. So a meeting was arranged at a hotel in Lincoln, Nebraska, which was sort of the in Ray's area, and the two guys agreed to fly out, and, you know, they had lunch together and chatted and had another meeting and various phone calls. And it basically came down to this scenario of this small think tank type group in the government, or it's perceived as being small. I was never really able to get sort of a fully clear picture on the size, but a think tank type group in the government that was looking at this idea that UFOs had of demonic origins and intents, and reportedly, you know, it received funding through official channels, etc. And excuse me. And Ray was told that the group itself, they never called, you know, these entities or whatever you want to call them, as demons or aliens. They called them NHEs, which stood for non-human entities. So, you know, I listened to what Ray had to say, and he told me how that the scientists came to initially believe they were dealing with extraterrestrials, but then it was like the project had this black cloud hanging over it. It just seemed, everything seemed negative, ill health and psychological issues and bad luck. A whole range of different things hit the project, as if the people had been cursed almost. And there were even deaths involved and different things. And eventually they came to believe that they were dealing with creatures that were masquerading as aliens to try and get their grips into the human race and deceive us on a large scale, and they wanted Ray's opinion, so, you know, he gave it, which was sort of in line and in accord. And he related this to me, and then that sort of pushed me down the path then of looking for more evidence and information sort of relative to this group.
And the Collins Elite, what is the meaning of that name? Kind of has an interesting
It's actually a weird origin. I mean, I have to be the first to admit, the Collins Elite, as it was related to me, the group members said that was its nickname, and that's how they always referred to it, of the seven or eight people from the group I spoke to. And that leads me to believe that it wasn't just a nickname that was applied to the group, but it was specifically used, because I have no proof of this, but I suspect that the real name is classified. And so it acts as like a convenient cover, that if somebody uses the Freedom of Information Act for information on the Collins Elite, you're not going to find it. It's like with the CIA, their nickname is the Company, you know, but there's no, you know, there's no agency of government called the Company, but there is one called the CIA, you know, you see what I mean? I think it's like that. But the name basically came from the town of, a little town called Collins in New York, where there just wasn't much going on, basically. And one of the people the group apparently had on board was a Quaker, who had a lot of knowledge sort of demonic history and things like that going back centuries. And they brought him on board as like a consultant, and because everybody else in town was sort of all involved in one little industry, I think it was making butter or something like that, but they jokingly called him the elite of Collins, because, you know, he had this sort of consultancy job he was doing with the Pentagon, and everybody else had this sort of relatively, you know, sort of day-to-day activity, and so they jokingly then called themselves the Collins elite. But it had no bearing on, I should say, it had no bearing on the work they were doing. I think it was like a joke, but then they realized it was something that could be, where the group could be talked about if they needed to, but without compromising, you know, what its real name was.
And you actually spoke to two of these, two of the men that were involved. How did they get in touch with you?
Well, this there's a couple of things I mentioned in the book where Ray gave me a few names, dates, and places which he preferred that I didn't publish.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I stand, if people don't want me to publish things, their names or whatever, or even dates, I don't, you know. But he said, for what it's worth, you know, here's a few snippets of information that might help put you on the track of at least who some of these people are. And basically, you know, a lot of researchers, they wonder, well, what should I do when I get something like this? And if you hit the brick wall, what I've found is you take an alternative approach and you just lay your cards on the table and you phone or you contact the press office or the PR office of this agency or that agency and say, hey, you know, I'm looking into this. Is it a valid story or is it just a hoax? You know, because if you really hit that brick wall, what have you got to lose? And what I found is that sometimes if you go knocking and people want to know why you're knocking, they'll come to you to find out. And I suspect that the reason why at least a couple of the people spoke to me was because I think there's like an effort at least on one's part to get the story into the public domain in a way where at first at least it can be gauged as to what the reaction is, and then release a bit more and release a bit more. And I suspect that might have been part of the case with Ray, that it wasn't just a case of wanting his opinion. It was to subtly seed the outline of the story to him, to see what he did with it and who he told and what their reaction was and what other people's reaction was. And that's what Ray did. He wrote about it, but very low-key.
Yeah.
So, you know, it didn't have that much of a response. But basically, it was through these leads that Ray provided, but which we didn't include in the book, that led me to a few people who was basically, you know, well, why are you looking into this? Why do you want to know? And I just literally laid my cards on the table. I told them the same story as I just told you about Ray. And the reason I did that was because Ray's story is public domain. As I said, he published it back around 94, 95. And so then it was a case of, well, why are you interested? What are you going to do with the information? And I was like, well, you know, it depends what the information is. If it's interesting enough, you know, I'd like to write something extensive about it and share it with people to see what they think of it. And that's really what it was. It wasn't a case of, you know, sort of deep throat type people coming to me, although they did act in a sort of a clandestine fashion. It was more, I think, that, you know, there's this sort of, even within the official world, I think like a subtle battle going on as to what we should know and what we shouldn't. And I think it was a case of some people wanting the story out there.
The Collins elite, they really get started, I think, in the early 50s. And that's in response to a guy named Jack Parsons.
Yeah, well, Jack Parsons was a very interesting and entertaining character.
Yeah, I think Luke would really like him.
Sounds like it, yeah.
Yeah, he was like a cool guy, you know. He was sort of, I don't know, he was almost like a punk rocker of his day, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He was totally anti-everything and just following his own path. But he was a brilliant rocket scientist. He was born in 1914, and by the sort of early 1930s, he was heavily involved in early rocket research. And he was actually the founder of NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, which is in Pasadena, California. And by the 1930s, you know, the military was realizing that, you know, they weren't so certainly at that stage looking at going to the moon or whatever, but they did realize that rockets represented the sort of next stage of technology to be used in warfare. So he was given funding and a grant, etc. And by the time of the Second World War, Parsons actually had a top secret clearance with the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, and he was heavily involved in doing rocket research, you know, from the perspective of launching what one day would become, you know, sort of modern day missiles and things like that. And he did this work, you know, and that was his sort of his day job, so to speak. But his other job, he was a big follower and devotee of Aleister Crowley, the famous occultist. And Crowley was, Parsons was actually offered by Crowley the job of running the office, if you like, in Pasadena, California, in Los Angeles. And so he was very much, you know, driven by research into the occult, and he was heavily interested in trying to summon up occult entities and things like that. And the military basically turned a blind eye. Files that have surfaced through the Freedom of Information Act today show that they were clearly aware of his relationship with Crowley, and everything was going, you know, that was going on. I mean, some of the files are really funny. Some of the official files talk about agents actually spying on Parsons' house and seeing, I'm quoting literally now, and in the files, it talks about groups of women of loose morals entering the house on a regular basis and things like that. So, you know, they're watching him very closely, but they realise he was a, you know, very good rocket scientist, and regardless of what he did in his free time, he was still a good rocket scientist. Now, in 1950, he was arrested and lost his clearance because he took some papers home from where he was working at the time, which was Howard Hughes's aircraft company. And the story was that he was applying for a job in Israel working for an aviation company, and so he wanted to take some notes home to refer to them, to basically which he could include information in his resume. But there was concern, you know, which is understandable concern, that he actually took the files to sell to Israel, but he was working as an undercover spy, so to speak.
Right.
That was never proved, but he did lose his security clearance. Now, Parsons also had a heavy and deep interest in UFOs, and actually claimed that he opened a portal or a doorway in 47 using all these magical rituals that let through these occult UFOs that today people view as alien spaceships. And a lot of the people who were involved in the early investigation of Parsons from the military and the intelligence community, because they were having to watch every aspect of his life, they picked up on the fact that he was saying, you know, he was responsible for UFOs, that they weren't extraterrestrial, that there was something occult, and he'd opened this gateway. So you had a bunch of different people from different agencies, all exposed to Parsons' work, all aware of all the different facets, whether it was his rocket stuff, his things with Crowley, his UFO angle, and they began to think, well, you know, this guy seems to be, you know, in on everything. And a couple of the people were actually also working on a lot of the early military programs looking at UFOs in 47 and 48. So they got interested. And then it was a case of a bunch of these guys getting together after work and having sort of round table meetings all about this. And then when somebody in the Pentagon heard about it, and this is when the Air Force was, you know, still struggling to understand what UFOs were, it was basically saying, a case of saying, well, you know, we've got this Project Blue Book that's looking at this angle, the CIA's Robertson panel is looking at this angle, why don't you guys look at this occult angle that Parsons, this guy who you've been investigating for the last 12 months, why don't you follow on that? So that's what happened, and funding was created, and so you had this, the birth of this group in a roundabout fashion, all because of the thing going on with Parsons in sort of 49 and 50.
And the ritual that he was doing was called the Babylon Working.
Yeah.
And it's B-A-B-A-L-O-N. And it's very interesting, too, because it's 47. I mean, that's the big date. You know, that's the Kenneth Arnold sighting. Yeah. That's the Roswell crash. I know you have your own theories on the Roswell crash, but you kind of posit a different theory in your book about Parsons possibly creating some kind of homunculus.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is, when we look at Parsons and the year 1947 with Kenneth Arnold, we can actually make a linkage between Parsons and Arnold. It's a bit of a complicated one, but Jack Parsons, for a while at least, was friends with L. Ron Hubbard, who founded Scientology. Hubbard was also, in the 40s, a prolific science fiction writer. And so you had a link between Parsons and Hubbard. Hubbard was also a colleague and friend of Ray Palmer, who was the editor of the sci-fi magazine Astounding Stories. And Ray Palmer was the co-author with Kenneth Arnold of Arnold's book, The Coming of the Flying Saucers. So you had Kenneth Arnold linked with Ray Palmer, you had Ray Palmer linked with Hubbard, and then you had Hubbard linked with Parsons. So you had a direct line between the four of them. Hmm. So that makes it all the more intriguing as well. But but Parsons was heavily involved in, like Crowley, not just understanding magic, but trying to invoke paranormal entities. That was basically the thrust of a lot of their work. And Crowley himself in 1918 conjured up this creature called Lam, L-A-M. And if you see pictures of Lam on the internet, I reproduced one in Final Event. He looks eerily like the being on the front of Whitley Strieber's book Communion. Sort of this large bald head and these penetrating eyes and little shoulders. It looks, aside from the fact that the eyes aren't pitch black, but it looks just like an alien grey. But in 47, when Parsons was involved, this whole Babylon work, and the idea was to sort of invoke these supernatural entities via these gateways, and he claimed that that's when he let this thing in. But he also claimed, in a roundabout way, the Collins elite, and I should stress, I've never been able to prove fully that the Collins elite and the group that Ray met their members of, it's exactly the same one, or if there might have been like an outgrowth or two groups following different paths. There are indications, sure, some of the stuff in the book, that there were at least two groups, maybe even three, following this occult path. And yeah, certainly one of them, Ray told me that the whole thing that they told him was that it all went back to Jack Parsons. So we know that they're all in accord on that angle. But the Collins elite, at least, they talk about how Parsons was trying to create like what's called a homunculus, which is like a magical little figure that you sort of breathe life into. And we know that he was supposed to be doing that in 1952 when he blew himself up in his lab and killed himself, unfortunately. But the story that they had regarding Roswell is that Roswell, they came to believe, was like some sort of Trojan horse, where there never was an actual crash or even an accident, but it was like a cunning Trojan horse type deception, where these demonic entities had literally sort of like weaved a technological alchemy. You know, alchemy is a change of base metals into precious metals, you know, like from tin into gold or whatever. Well, they came to believe, you know, that these entities could sort of weave atoms in the universe to create the sort of the memory foil, you know, the debris that was reportedly found at Roswell, and also to create homunculus-style jackalopes almost, you know, like manufactured bodies that had never really lived. And they could do it by, you know, manipulating matter and atoms to create what was in all essence a life form but that wasn't real. And then sort of strategically place all this stuff in the desert as a means to have the military believe that they'd just been visited by extraterrestrials, and more importantly, these were vulnerable extraterrestrials who could die and crash, etc., when in other words, they were trying to sort of set the scene when the reality was the exact opposite from the Collins elite's perspective, that they were actually almost like indestructible entities that couldn't be killed because they lacked physical form, so they had to sort of manipulate matter to create something that would do their job for them, if you like. Which is probably the wildest, you know, scenario for Roswell ever presented, I think.
Oh yeah, definitely.
What were you saying about the foil? You said something about memory foil or being at the crash site?
At the crash site, this is one of the interesting things, you know, when people say, what came down at Roswell? Many of the military guys who worked there, and even the families of some of the locals who saw and handled the wreckage before the military got on site, talked about finding this huge field of this metallic debris that was described as looking and feeling like foil, but when you would squash it up, it would immediately return to its original form, like it had an inherited memory or something like that. So that was basically what the material was described as being, and these people came to conclude that, again, it was like a form of alchemy, like sort of transmutating some sort of like the atomic structure, whatever, and then, you know, creating it to appear to be some technologically advanced material when it was just sort of waved, you know, sort of like an alchemic fashion or something.
I see.
And about the Collins elite, one of the things that they looked into a lot was kind of the link between UFOs, alien abductions, out-of-body experiences. What was the conclusion that they came to about the nature of all those phenomena?
Yeah, well, this is an interesting angle, because one of the things I found during the research was that strands of this whole... over time, I should preface this by saying that some of their views changed and were modified over time.
Right.
You know, although they held to the Christian perspective, they weren't above sort of modifying it when they felt the information was suited their needs. And we see evidence as time goes on that, I mean, certainly in the 50s and 60s, I didn't see any evidence that they were involved in looking at out-of-body experience links to the UFO phenomenon or abductions. But by the 70s, they were. I mean, there's one classic case involving a helicopter pilot. It's actually 40 years ago. In October of this year, Captain Coyne, a military pilot who was flying a helicopter in Ohio, coming into land, and him and the crew, they saw this bright green sort of disc-shaped UFO that literally sort of loomed right in front of them. And in the days and weeks afterwards, Captain Coyne and several of the crew members were telephoned by somebody from the Pentagon and asked questions about, have you had any out-of-body experiences? And they went on record, but of course, nobody realized the significance back then that this probably was the people from the Collins elite or a similar organization asking these questions. But nevertheless, sure. They went on record as saying, you know, we got these calls, and I'm not sure they were, but they wanted to know, you know. And the one guy said, yeah, he dreamt just after the experience that he was dead and looking over his body. Yeah. Now, the Collins elite came to believe that the human soul is like an energy force, and they came to the conclusion, a highly controversial conclusion, and I always preface this by saying that, you know, as far as I know, and as the Collins elite also admitted, it was a belief system. It wasn't anything they could prove. It was just a belief. But they came to believe that the human soul is built on energy, and it's possible to siphon that energy and essentially for entities that are energy-based, they can, in simple terms, feed on the soul energy. So they viewed the whole purpose of these entities was to sort of recycle souls in what they came to term soul factories. The best way I can describe it, if you think of the original Matrix movie, you know, where Keanu Reeves wakes up and realizes the real world's just a dream, and the real world is, you know, all these endless pods where we're all farmed for electrical energy by all these machines. Well, they came to view the afterlife as not being sort of pitchforks and like a fiery furnace, but some other form of dimension where souls were sort of lined up in their billions and siphoned off of the energy for these entities. And, you know, it's a wild, bizarre and unsettling scenario. You know, the idea is that the Earth is like the farm. You know, we're the cattle grazing in the field. And when the cattle go to the slaughterhouse, we go to the... Or we all go to the factory where all this energy is siphoned off bit by bit.
Yeah, they're coming to eat our souls, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Again, I always preface by saying, you know, this isn't, the book isn't meant to be intended as Nick Redfern pounding on the table saying, you know, you've got to run to the hills, this is what's going on.
Yeah.
The book is a study of how and why this group came to those conclusions, because I found it a fascinating story. It's not me, you know, demanding that we all run for cover or whatever, you know what I mean?
Right. But they had some interesting ideas, though, too, that they had seen things that they believed to be demonic manifestations, and they had some ideas to prevent that from taking place. What were some of their ideas that they had?
What, demonic manifestations, you mean?
Yeah, like they were going to try to do... like a Project Bluebeam kind of thing, where they were going to...
Oh, I see. Sorry, yeah. I mean, there was some weird stuff. I mean, again, a lot of it was sort of round table stuff they admitted to. We were just, you know, talking and ideas. And they came to believe that it was possible to keep these entities at bay by denial in belief of their existence. That's to say, it was a very weird thing. It was almost like they were saying that if you don't believe in these things, their power to affect us is lessened. Kind of like, I guess, if you hold a, the movies, you hold up a cross at a vampire, but if you don't really have faith, the cross doesn't work. You know, it's kind of that sort of thing. And they came to believe that if there was enough belief, we could hold these beings at bay forever. But they believed, or they concluded, there wasn't enough belief. And one of the ideas they claimed to have looked at was the idea of, like, faking a religious event in the skies, you know, like a second coming, and to the point where everybody became believers. And then that would create such a show of strength that these entities wouldn't be able to break through it. So it was a case of creating a ruse and a lie, but as they saw it, for the good of everyone, even if it meant deceiving them in the process. Now, as the people stressed to them, you know, if you look on the internet, you look at Project Bluebeam, there's all this stuff about, you know, the satellites up there and they're ready to do it and whatever. Yeah. You know, like a charade, religious charade. The people I spoke with, at least, said it wasn't like that at all. It was like a round table meeting to determine if it was even feasible, if the technology even existed. And, you know, they kind of thought about it, and it was viewed as a bit off the wall. But, you know, who knows what's going on behind the scenes, certainly in things like sophisticated hologram research, that kind of thing, you know.
I know there was an idea, too, that they had, was that they wanted to kind of increase the extent of kind of Christian beliefs in the U.S. military, and that was something else that they had thought of doing.
The idea of really sort of instilling it here, there, and everywhere. And, you know, some people, I mean, they didn't view themselves as bad guys. They felt they were, okay, they were doing underhanded things and behind the scenes and manipulating people, but they felt, you know, it was for the better good of the people in the end. But the idea was to sort of, you know, reinforce the Christian doctrines and beliefs, whether people wanted it or not, because if they didn't, it would be a worse situation for them anyway. So they viewed that what they were doing was right, I guess.
Nick, do you think that they've succeeded in some of that stuff?
Well, you know, it's difficult to know, because, I mean, we're talking about a think tank in the government that had...
Yeah.
We know it had a lot of support and funding, and certainly people like Ronald Reagan. You know, Ronald Reagan was heavily interested in UFOs, but he was also deeply interested in, you know, end time scenarios and the apocalypse and Armageddon. You know, he possessed a number of books on that sort of stuff. So from that perspective, it's not surprising that there are people in government who I think shared their views, because I'm certain, although I can't prove it, that there was obviously some, you know, connection between probably the Reagan administration and the Collins elite, and some of the people allude to that in the book. But to what extent, you know, they actually have an influence on sort of official policy, I mean, I think that's dependent upon, you know, who's in power and who wields the power at any given time. And it's difficult to really know, you know. I think the important thing to remember is that, you know, over the years, there have been a lot of think tanks and groups and different projects within government and the military that have addressed the UFO issue from a lot of different angles. So even in government, there's not like a consensus that it's this or that. And I think that's probably the same with the Collins elite. And, you know, like when Ray met these people, that it was a project, it was a group, one of many, and some people supported it, and others might have supported the extraterrestrial angle. So it really is just difficult, you know, in other words, to sort of know how much power they wield and to what extent, or is it just, you know, are they talking to themselves, you know what I mean?
Yeah. One of the most interesting parts of the book, and I was actually rereading this part, this section today, was kind of the link that you draw in it, but like the mythological creatures of Babylon, of Greece, Rome, and kind of how that fits in with like the modern day alien abduction lore, and like the significance of the owl is very interesting too.
Yeah, Yeah, well, that's actually one of the major things that they were looking into. I mean, the one of the things I found was that, as well as sort of looking at modern-day UFO reports and cases and studying them, they had a bunch of people, again, I'm not sure how many, but they certainly had people in their employ whose entire job was to sort of pore over ancient manuscripts, you know, sort of dusty old volumes going back to the 1500s on, you know, raising the dead or, you know, raising demons or whatever, you know, sort of volumes are probably worth, I don't know, a couple of hundred thousand grand or whatever, but barely get let out of libraries or that kind of thing. And one of the things I found was a lot of interesting parallels between things like today's abduction stories and abductions and encounters with paranormal entities thousands of years ago that displayed a lot of similarities. Certainly in ancient Babylonia, they had reports where these sort of evil entities would break into people's homes at night, and they would steal babies. You know, that you'd also have sort of the stories of the incubi and the succubi, sort of male and female paranormal supernatural creatures that would have sex in the middle of the night with humans. You know, so you've got like the genetic and the reproductive angle. And sometimes they would steal babies and leave what was called a changeling, which was looked like a human baby but wasn't. So you've almost got like the hybrid baby angle also that you have with abductions. And from there, they started digging into like Middle Ages Europe and things like fairy encounters. You know, fairy encounters, people think of fairies today. You think of like, you know, Tinkerbell and little female character with wings. That imagery is actually only a production of like the last 150 years. Before that, they were sort of seen as like shadowy, sinister, malevolent little creatures that could be both friendly and hostile, depending on how you dealt with them. And you can find stories going back hundreds of years where this fairy encounter, you know, might begin with somebody walking in the woods late at night, and they'd see these fairy lights, you know, which you could class as the UFO. Then you would see these little beings come out of the fairy lights, which were fairies, or were they aliens? Then, you know, the person gets taken to the fairy queen kingdom. They might meet the fairy queen, and if it's a man, you know, he's made to mate with the fairy queen to create these magical offsprings between fairy creatures and humans, which can traverse both worlds. And the person then, you know, gets taken back to the woods, and they think an hour's gone by when 2 days has gone by. And there are countless reports like that. So you've got the missing time angle as well. And they came to believe that from ancient Babylon through Middle Ages Europe through abductions, it was the exact same phenomenon, but presenting itself in a way that was more relevant to the people of the era. So, you know, they would instill the idea 3,000 years ago. They were paranormal. 500 years ago, you know, they portrayed themselves as fairies. Today, it's extraterrestrials. And what's interesting, if you look, even over the last 60 years, we see a massive change in the phenomenon. You know, back in the 40s, it was all flying saucers. Nobody really sees flying saucers now. Literal flying saucers with the tripod landing marks and things like that.
Right, right.
But black triangles. Back in the 50s, the aliens were sort of like the long-haired space brother type in the contactee stories. In the 60s, yeah, they were shorter and smaller, but the greys didn't really pop up until the sort of mid-70s onwards. Back in the 50s and 60s, you always had reports of aliens landing and taking soil samples and running back to the ship. So it's almost as if the phenomenon it's changed for us, you know, right, from the 40s to now, never mind, you know, across the centuries. It's like it's changing as our beliefs change. You know, they used to say they were from Venus or Mars. Now it's from some faraway star system because we know they're probably not from Venus.
Yeah, we sent the Voyager out, and, you know, now they say, well, we're from Zeta Reticuli, or we're from some other, or Sirius, you know, we're the Ashtar Command, or something like that. The owl is also interesting. That kind of, the screen memory aspect of it is interesting, I mean, too.
Yeah, well, in a lot of abduction stories today, you get reports of people who say, you know, they're driving home late at night, they got home late, realized they'd missed 2 hours or whatever, couldn't understand what had happened, and say for the next 3 nights they dreamed They were driving along the car, and they saw like a 5 foot tall or 4 foot tall owl staring at them from the side of the road, which, you know, it's not every day you see a 5 foot owl staring at you. And yeah. So, excuse me. And so, basically, if this just happened once, you know, you could just say, well, it's just a weird dream that happened after you had a missing time or whatever. But we have a lot of stories on record where people have had these experiences where they've had missing time, their dreams have been taken on board something, fragments of memories, but it all seems to be dominated by imagery of owls. And it's been suggested that the owl imagery is inserted by these alien entities as a cover to mask the fact that they've had a UFO encounter. You know, if you remember it, it was just an owl with penetrating eyes staring at you from the trees or whatever. And so that in itself is interesting. But when we go back again to ancient Babylonia, we find that back then owls were seen as like supernatural creatures that were linked with the realm of the dead, and some of these paranormal creatures would manifest in the form of like a monstrous type of owl. So, you know, we have ties like this going through the entire phenomenon again. You know, is it just a screen memory designed to further bolster the idea that it's something it is, but it actually really isn't?
And it's interesting too that owls turn up in the occult. You know, like, I mean, you have, you know, the goddess Athena in Greek mythology with the owl, the symbol of wisdom, but it also turns up in like the Bohemian. That's the symbol of the Bohemian Grove. Several, you know, secret societies have the owl as a symbol. So it's interesting that there's that kind of there's an interesting connection there somewhere, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's one that a lot of people won't know about, but I'm sure most of your listeners will have heard of the famous Mothman that John Keel made famous in the Mothman prophecies, this sort of glowing-eyed winged creature. Well, Britain has its own version, which is seen in the woods of the county of Cornwall, a very ancient county in the southwest of England. And that one is known as Owlman, because it's like a humanoid character or figure with wings, but it has a face which is more like an owl, but also has these glowing red eyes with a typical Mothman. And so again, you have another owl link there as well. So a lot of weird stuff like that going on.
Yeah, there's a lot of strangeness going on with owls. Luke and I have noticed that too. Since you've written the book, has there been any contact with the Collins elite? Have you heard anything that they've done lately?
That's an interesting thing. A lot of people ask me that, and there actually hasn't been. And I think this is a deliberate move, which goes back to what I said before. And even the attempts I've made have just been sort of brushed off. And I think it comes back to the fact that when Ray was approached, I think this was a genuine attempt to perhaps get something out, and maybe it stalled. And I know that in 1994, Linda Howe had contact with Ray's two sources as well by letter. They wrote letters to her, although she didn't meet them in person. And that didn't really go anywhere. And, you know, maybe just through chance, when I decided to speak to Ray and he opened up about it, it was another chance. You know, let's see what happens with this information. And again, although I can't prove it, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, there wasn't a great deal of observance of the reaction that the book brought in the UFO community. And it wouldn't surprise me in the slightest if they're not already speaking to somebody else but who, you know, maybe take it to the next level beyond just a book, you know what I mean?
Right.
I think what they're doing is subtly trying to spread the story. It's almost like a under the radar meme or something like that. And then, you know, take it to another level and another level. And maybe, you know, Ray was the first tier, then somebody approached Linda Howe, and that was the second. Final events was the next one. Maybe somebody else, you know, has been invited to sit in on the group. I mean, who knows? I'm speculating. But I think because, you know, the door's been closed to me now, I think it's not coincidence. I think it's like a step-by-step procession that somebody wants to see. Well, what would happen if we released it, you know, to everybody? And the reason why I think they've done that is because, if you think about it psychologically, the 3,000 or 4,000 people that sort of regularly attend the conferences, you know, take part in the chat rooms, listen to the radio shows or whatever, they're an easy audience to monitor, but they're a widespread diversity of the entire population. So you could you can actually get a good idea of the entire population's views by watching a clear small group that you can watch closely. You see what I mean? So I think that's the reasoning behind it, is to gauge what everyone would think by targeting a small audience to start with.
Nick, do you yourself, do you put any stock in the demonic theory of UFOs?
That's the big question I get asked a lot. I mean,
sure.
My personal view, you know, when I got into the whole UFO thing as a kid, you know, I thought it's all extraterrestrial. Excuse me. I thought it was all extraterrestrial and, you know, nuts and bolts spacecraft, and the government was hiding, you know, alien bodies in the refrigerator or whatever. And that maybe they are. You know, maybe that is exactly what's going on. The college elite are just too caught up in their beliefs. But if people ask me, you know, I don't personally believe that we can literally interpret this as demonic. Now, one of the, you know, a lot of people, religion causes a lot of friction in the world, as we know. You know, there are a lot of different religions, and they clearly, you know, can't all be correct. And it's not my, you know, I'm not trying to offend anybody who's a believer in this or a believer in that. But
sure,
when they all have different beliefs, or differing beliefs at least, clearly a substantial number of people have got to be wrong if one of them's right. Now, the Collins elite, well, I believe what their big mistake was in not interpreting the phenomenon as paranormal rather than alien, but insisting it's this and nothing else, you know, which is what they did. They said, it's got to be this. We know this is what it is, and we're going to follow this angle because that's what it is. My view today, the more I've dug into the UFO subject, I am actually less inclined to think it's extraterrestrial, and I'm more inclined to think it's interdimensional or extra-dimensional, that these things coexist with us and probably always have. I'm not sure they're cut from one galaxy or another. So that I believe they're literally alien in the sense they're not from here. But, you know, things like quantum physics today are allowing for the existence of multi-dimension. I think they're probably something like that. And it wouldn't surprise me, and again, you know, not meant to offend, but it wouldn't surprise me if the ancients knew a lot about these extra dimensions and perceived them as like, you know, heaven or hell or whatever.
Yeah. The last show we had on, a guy named Adam Ellenboss, who had experiences with ayahuasca. And some of his experiences are very similar to some of the things alien abductees experience as well.
Yeah. I mean, you can find it, you know, in researching things like DMT, you know, people who've undergone basically trips, you know, in sort of like a carefully controlled environment, and they've sort of seen their minds open to what they believe entities coming through, you know, and it's, but they don't believe they're hallucinating, you know, they believe that it opens a door, so to speak. So I think we are dealing with creatures that aren't extraterrestrial, and maybe they do masquerade as extraterrestrial as a cover, and I think a lot of them could well be hostile to us, but I don't think then that necessarily means it proves there's like a fiery pit and this guy with horns and a forked tail. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
It means that there could be realms where malevolent evil creatures exist and they interact with us and they manipulate us, and I think that's entirely possible, but I don't put the spin on it that it's, you know, a place where there is a literal demon or a literal devil, you know.
Right.
I think we're dealing with something that perhaps can be explained more scientifically, but over years, you know, you have the various beliefs relating to, you know, this religion or that religion constructed around it, you know.
Well, Nick, I wanted to change subject to something a little lighter.
It couldn't get much darker, really.
Yeah, I know, yeah. The cover of your book has a gray alien with a demon behind it with a mushroom cloud. So,
It kind of looks a bit cartoonish. A lot of people don't like the cover. That isn't really how I envisioned it.
Oh, I love it.
I wanted something a bit more sinister, you know, where it was less cartoonish and more kind of, you know, H.P. Lovecraft, you know, sort of like a shadowy demon hovering over the White House or something.
Yeah, like Cthulhu or something. I wanted to turn to something a little lighter, and that's something that I know that you've studied a lot, and being where you are in Texas, and that's the chupacabra.
Oh yeah.
What is your kind of theory on what that is?
Well, yeah, that's my big interest, bigger than UFOs, is cryptozoology, which is a study of unknown animals. And I've probably written about broadly the same amount of books on UFOs as I have cryptozoology. But the Chupacabra is interesting because you have two variations of it. You have the original one from Puerto Rico, which sort of sprang up in the early 1990s. Then you have the sort of so-called Texas Chupacabra of the last 6 or 7 years. And a lot of people assume, well, the Chupacabra's made its way from Puerto Rico. But when you look into the stories, we find that the Puerto Rican version is actually quite different to the American one. I've been on a number of expeditions to Puerto Rico looking for that one. And most of the witnesses describe like a bipedal creature, like a chimpanzee, something about the size of a chimpanzee and speed and muscle strength, but completely hairless with these glowing red eyes and like spikes going down his head and neck, like a mohawk, like a punk rock mohawk or something like that. And so it looks pretty hostile and lethal. People talk about farm animals being drained of blood, and I've spoken to ranchers and veterinarians who've confirmed they've literally sort of found puncture wounds and blood drain from the bodies. Now, when these attacks sort of kicked off in the 2000s in Texas, that were attributed to this weird sort of hairless creature that looks like a giant hairless rat, the people said, well, it's got to be the Chupacabra because, it's attacking animals in the same way, farm animals, etc. But when we look into it, what we find is that, the creatures are very different. They do look like hairless coyotes, and in some cases, the DNA has been extracted from them, and they do show evidence of DNA, at least coyote DNA present. However, skeptics will say that, they're just, coyotes with mange, but they're not. When we look at these corpses at a closer degree, what we actually find is that many of them, the front legs are actually shorter than they should be, so it gives them like this weird kangaroo-like hopping movement. There are some reports, or actually quite a few reports, where people have said they've seen these creatures stand up on their hind legs and even run on their hind legs, which is bizarre. But some animals do that. A bear can stand on its hind legs and it won't sort of run at 90 miles an hour on its hind legs.
Right.
It can waddle along. Now, also with these Texas Chupacabras, some of them, the top jaw seems to be growing longer than the bottom jaw. They're supposed to be uniform and joined together, but it has like a huge overbite. There are also examples where the tail seem to be growing at an extra length as well. And as far as the mange is concerned, well, mange is caused by a mite, which causes localized or extensive hair loss in an animal. But one of the side effects is that the animals, it just irritates them and drives them crazy, that they just scratch themselves to the point where they dig into the skin, it bleeds, and infection sets in. And so they're just covered in scabs and sores and all this sort of hairless skin. Now, these creatures, however, the Texas Chupacabra, they're not showing the evidence of the intense scratching and biting and chewing. They're also not showing evidence of patchy hair loss, which is often the case in mange. They're showing complete, total hair loss. And there have even been reports of people seeing pups with the adults, and they're totally hairless. So it's like, almost if there's been a spontaneous mutation in the species at a genetic level in the last 10 or 15 years. And they're also displaying no fear of people, which coyotes, will often run away during the day. These things stand their ground. Yeah. There are a couple of reports where people claimed these things started to circle them, almost like as a group, as if they were planning an attack. So in other words, we have the Puerto Rican Chupacabra, we have the Texas one. They're both weird. They both show evidence of not being normal animals, but they don't appear to be the same creature, so to speak.
Do you think that they're possibly a hybrid between dog and coyote?
Well, I mean, we found evidence of wolf and coyote DNA, and also in one case, dog and coyote. So, there is a bit of a mixture going on, but that in itself shouldn't explain the hair loss. It shouldn't explain the overbite. It shouldn't explain the differences in the limbs, etc., things like that. I've actually got a photograph of one of these that a guy took in Oklahoma, a little town called Tecumseh, back in 2010. And this thing is literally like bouncing on its back legs. You know, it's got these little front limbs, kind of like, you know, you see like a Tyrannosaurus, you know, this huge creature, you have these little hanging front limbs. It's like that. It just looks so weird. So something, I think, is going on. And the speed of it suggests, when I said like a mutation in the species, it's almost like an overnight type of thing, almost literally. You know?
From the kind of the side of what you're saying, it seems to be that there's a lot of sightings. A lot of people have seen these things, and there's been dead bodies. Do you think that biological science is ready to accept them?
Well, you see, the problem is science does accept them, but they just say, well, yeah, it's got DNA from a coyote in it or a wolf in it, and it's hairless. So it's a hairless coyote mixed with a wild dog. And they acknowledge that. Scientists acknowledge that, but they won't take that other step. You know, they kind of ignore the overbites and the front limbs and, you know, the... just say, oh, well, it's just people's perspective, how they were looking at it when they saw the creature. It wasn't really hopping, you know.
And so, they're not ready to say it's a new species or something.
No, or even a mutation. They're just saying it's a hairless coyote and mange spreads, you know, from one animal to another and et cetera, et cetera. If they live in packs and they leave it at that. So it's not a denial of existence. It's a denial of the implications of what's going on.
Well, Nick, we'll have to get you back on to talk about cryptozoology. That's a interesting thing that we haven't really talked about on the show very much.
We had that one. Who was the guest that talked about cryptozoology?
Micah Hanks, I think. He talked about Bigfoot.
Yeah, Micah's a good friend of mine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Micah's great. Does an awesome Alex Jones impression. what are you working on now, Nick?
I've actually got a new book out right now. It's called Monster Files. It came out last week, and it's a study of what government agencies know about weird creatures. I got hold of things like British Royal Navy files on sightings of sea serpents by military sailors, Air Force interest in Bigfoot reports, where Bigfoot have been seen in the same vicinity and time frame as UFOs. Kind of things like that, you know, where the official world has taken an interest in, you know, everything from Bigfoot to the Abominable Snowman, even to the Loch Ness Monster and things like that.
Sure.
Have you watched these new mermaid documentaries that have just came out?
Well, I didn't see this one, but I saw the first one, which came out like last year, and, you know, it's entertaining, but you can tell it's like a, you know, it's a spoof.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, yeah, it was hard for me to buy it. All of the evidence that they had was just a hand. A webbed hand keeps coming out and touching the window on their submarine. And
yeah, that's right.
What?
Yeah, things like that. You know, that's the only real solid evidence that they could find. And the videos,
I mean, I think it wasn't a badly made show if you kind of view it as, you know, like a bit of entertainment. But I understand why. I mean, a lot of people were kind of angered by it. They felt, you know, they were being lied to. But you know, I guess it depends if you view it as a fake presented as real, or do you view it as like a light-hearted spoof or something? You know, it's all on
right.
You, the way you look at it, I guess. I suppose
there's two videos that they had that showed the mermaids really clearly, but it's too easy to fake nowadays with all of the technology.
Yeah, it did look like CGI, and I mean, it was a good premise. You know, it wasn't like they were presenting them as like hot looking mermaids like Daryl Hannah in Splash or whatever, you know. It wasn't like that. You know, they looked more like the creature from the Black Lagoon, which was sort of like a, you know, an interesting approach. They presented them as sort of like gruesome looking fish people, something like that.
Right.
What I did find interesting was that, you know, they had the they claimed that in the show, you know, the scientists all worked for the National Oceanic Agency of the US government. Uh-huh. Right after the show was broadcast, the NOAA actually put a big thing up on their white website saying, no, we have not got any evidence that mermaids are real. And you know, they actually felt they had to respond on their official website.
Right.
And of course, this gave rise, well, are they protesting too much? Do they know that mermaids really do exist?
There's a cover-up. They're covering up the mermaids.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, he does have a legitimate excuse for the cover-up, and that is if people found out that there was an endangered species, you know, of these proto-people in the water.
Proto-fish people?
Yeah, the proto-fish people, yeah. then they would have to stop the industry from drilling for oil, you know, all over Iceland.
You know, I mean, that sounds bizarre, but what is interesting is that's one of the reasons why some people have suggested the government won't acknowledge the existence of Bigfoot, because if it's some form of primitive human and it lives in the woods, an argument could be made that its entire territory, you know, should be preserved. And of course, that could sort of collapse the lumber and timber industries overnight.
Right.
And so one of the theories is that's one of the reasons why the government won't admit to it, because it would open the door for it being, you know, recognized as an endangered species, and what would that do, you know, to the forests that are cut down every year for trees and, I mean, for wood or whatever, you know.
And one of the things I've heard about Bigfoot is that I think Lauren Coleman made this point, was that Bigfoot probably has been shot out in the wild, possibly, and when the hunters get to what they shot, they freak out because they think they probably just killed some hippie out in the woods, and then they just don't say a word about it.
Well, yeah, there are a number of stories, you know, where people claim to have shot and killed a Bigfoot and thought, you know, well, I've just killed a Bigfoot, you know, I'm going to be the guy who proves that there's a weird ape in the US. And then when they've got right up to it, they've seen its face, and it's sort of, it looks more like a primitive human than it does an animal. And then they start to worry, well, am I going to be charged with murder, you know, which, joking aside, I mean, who knows if he was a primitive human, what the laws would be, you know. I mean, right. I think the first time, at least, a person wouldn't be charged. But if it was proved, you know, that it possessed human DNA, then laws would be put into place. But I think the first person wouldn't have anything to worry about, you know, apart from their conscience, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, you know, there's interesting things like this. A lot of people don't think of the legal angles of what if, you know.
Mm-hmm. Nick, before we go, we'll put you on the spot. Just wanted to know your favorite British punk band.
Oh, that's easy, the Sex Pistols.
Gotcha. I know you're a bit, I've seen on Facebook you're a big fan of punk. I am too, so.
Yeah, I kind of like, you know, the classic earlier stuff and sort of the later, heavier stuff like The Exploited and GBH and those type of bands. And I like some of the later sort of poppier punk stuff, you know, it's sort of generic, but it's okay, you know.
Was that part of the music, the magazine you wrote for? What was it kind of like? Was it about punk rock, or was it about like other things?
That was just zero. That was just across the board, you know. It was like a regional guy, you know, for like a what's on thing in the area. So you know, whatever bands were coming to town and stuff like that, it would, you know, it would cover all that kind of thing.
Cool. Well, Nick, we want to thank you for coming on, being a guest. You're a really good guest, and really want to thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I appreciate you having me on, guys. Had a good time. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you.
So stay in the line for us, Nick, and we're just going to close section out. And Luke, if there's anything else, we're just...
Go for it.
We'll be back on Conspiranormal. All right, we are back on Conspiranormal. You know me. It's your host, Adam Sane.
We really need to drop the introduction.
I know, I know. Like everybody knows who we are by now. This is show 29.
Just introduce ourselves one time.
Yeah, I know. Just like, this is it. We're done. All right. Luke, what'd you think of Nick Redfern, man? That was a
he's great.
Awesome interview.
You know, and you're kind of notioning to me like, you know, ask him a question. A question. I just felt like I didn't need to, because everything he was saying, I agree with, you know.
Yeah.
He's got the same mindset about, he was talking about spiritual energy being collective, and that energy being able to be manipulated by an occult magician to accomplish tasks, you know, either through evil or good,
mm-hmm.
angels and demons. You know, it's all the same stuff that I'm into, that I read sometimes, and that I meditate on and everything else. So I could call myself an occultist.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, you could. I mean, there's... because occult just really means hidden knowledge, basically. But I was kind of chuckled when he mentioned the succubus stuff, because you had been talking about how your ex-girlfriend was a succubus.
It's, you know, lately. Yeah. everybody kind of takes it as a lighthearted joke, and that's cool, you know. That's not, but it's for real. It's serious. And the way I try to...
You're thinking of it more like an energy vampire kind of thing.
Exactly. Everybody knows what an energy vampire is. You've been in public, and you've been in a public place, and you've met somebody who's just drained you, and you didn't know why. Yeah. It wasn't because that they talked too much, or they asked too many questions, or they had a lot more energy than you, or something like that. They were just genuinely tiring to be around.
Sure.
And... that's kind of, you know, that is the definition of a succubus, but just in more an intimate, you know, relationship term.
Or an incubus in the male form, right?
Yeah. Succubus, in my case.
Succubi.
Yeah, I mean, and I've got this kind of idea that I've been working with that, you know, once you have sexual relations with a girl, that you're kind of cursed by them in a sense. I'm serious.
That may be true. I don't know.
And they will continue to take your energy over long distances and stuff because you're spending all your time dwelling and thinking about, you know, the last girl that you were with.
Is that how you felt this last time?
Yeah. I mean, no. It is. And I had to seriously struggle to get her out of my head. Like I was telling you, she was invading my dreams. And I wasn't trying to dream about her. I wasn't thinking about her before I'm going to sleep. She was stealing my energy from me, and it took, you know, a lot for me to kind of just get rid of her, get rid of that.
Well, now may be a good time since we're kind of on that subject. A few shows ago, I can't remember exactly when that was. I'm sure I could look if I could find out. But you had talked about possibly doing some... magical rituals against somebody,
right?
That's you know, I kind of disapproved of it, but you have decided against that. So what was your reasoning?
Well,
it
had to do with my most recent girlfriend, like I was saying on that one
episode.
This
is the succubus.
Yeah, and I figured, what better time than to try to experiment with something that. To experiment with like a dark art and see if I could actually make it work, if I could execute it and see it in action before my own eyes, you know. And I am just happy with the fact that I know that I do have that kind of power now.
Yeah,
I don't even have to go and execute it because.
But you felt it was dangerous.
And it's because you read up or you've heard all of these kind of old folk tales about, you know, old magic and how you'd have to trade something in. It's going to be a consequence for you to have this magical task done. Like, you know, we want 4 pints of virgin's blood for going and killing this guy. You know what I'm saying? Old folklore kind of talks about evocation of demons and stuff that way.
It's just like Jack Parsons, right?
Right.
You do your own Babylon working?
In a sense, yeah. He's probably a little more advanced than me and has read more on the subject.
He probably was.
Well, thanks. But,
that's probably a good thing that you're not, okay?
I just found out that it drags you down, too, if you want to try to accomplish a darker task. Because, if you... That's the easy way. It's kind of hard to explain. If you wanted to use darkness against someone else, you, in a sense, yourself, would have to go into a darker place.
Yeah.
And because if you look at it as, just like we were talking a minute ago about manipulating spirit energy to accomplish a task, then you would have to reflect the darkness, you know, with the energy that you're going to use. So it just drags you down with it.
Yeah.
And you might as well just go, if you got a beef with someone, just go fight them. Just go beat them half to death. Don't use, you know, dark arts against them. It just makes no sense.
What did you think about what Nick was saying, or some of the stuff that we were talking about the Babylonian time period, the Roman mythology, kind of like the alien abduction lore now, stuff about the owl, which, you know, you and I have talked about that a lot.
I was actually gone to get a glass of water while he was talking about the owl stuff.
Yeah, I think you came. You heard some
of
that.
I heard the tail end of it, yeah. But yeah, he's right, and I was thinking a lot about that throughout the ages, how the views on extraterrestrials have changed. You know, like you're saying that it used to be this idea that it was just some guys in spacesuits and you couldn't really make out their face, and then it turned into the Greys eventually in the 2000s, 90s and 2000s and stuff. And it just goes to show to me, it's just more evidence that I don't believe that extraterrestrials are just physical, solid beings that are coming here in ships. It's just, I think it's actually acts of, you know, magical acts. Like whenever someone sees a UFO, that could be someone actually doing a ceremony, you know, to attack somebody else or something.
Well, this whole idea of Jack Parsons doing the Babylon working and basically bringing something into this world, kind of like into a portal. 1947, I think we've mentioned this before, but was kind of is really a key year. I mean, you've got the first UFO sighting.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the the first, you know, kind of modern day UFO sighting, because there were things that happened with the Foo Fighters and stuff, World War II, stuff beyond that.
Right.
But it kind of begins in earnest at that time. And you have whatever it was that happened at Roswell, you have that in 47.
Yeah.
Aleister Crowley dies in 1947. Uh-huh. There's some of the things like in Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, you know, the same, the line, 20 years ago today, Sgt. Pepper taught the band to play. Some people that think that that's a reference to Aleister Crowley, because that album was in 1967. And 1947 was when Aleister Crowley died. And of course, Aleister Crowley is on the cover of the album.
Huh.
And not only all that, and kind of like the supernatural cult realm, 1947 is also for the United States, is really kind of the Cold War begins in earnest. You know, you have the beginning of kind of the national security state with the NSA being established, the national...
A lot was going on
in 1947.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that he's bringing in a portal, you know, it seems like the time was just right for that to happen.
Especially since all magical workings, you know, occultism have to do with precise times and moon phases, lunar, solar phases, and everything else.
I'm very, very intrigued by that kind of thing. Yeah. By the whole like homunculus
aspect. And that's another thing. That's another thing I was thinking about while he was mentioning all that. I was like, man, that would take just a massive effort for, you know, to materialize through alchemic, you know, whatever, to make that tinfoil looking stuff that was out in the field. And how many bodies were discovered, did they say, in Roswell?
Supposedly three.
Yeah, three homunculi. Like, you would have to have a whole group of magicians in on this, and to actually materialize something like that would take, like, you know, mastery.
There's strange connections, too, with Parsons. One of the things that Nick didn't mention was that Parsons considered himself to be the Antichrist. Crowley did, too, incidentally. Now, whether that they literally thought themselves to be like kind of the Christian Antichrist, or whether it was just kind of a figurative thing,
that's probably mention, seems to be for attention.
He did, there's all kinds of stuff like that. But Parsons did say that he did say Parsons was born in 1914, and there was a preacher that before that had said that, you know, the end of the world, or the beginning of the end of the world, was going to start in 1914. So you have all sorts of weird, you know, another date. And 1914 is very important. That's the beginning of the First World War. You know, that basically really kind of kicks off, in many ways, the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
So where was I going with all that? Mine is blown.
We're just talking about, you know, ordered dates and specific times, and
so I think you're right. Is that, you know, the time seemed to have been right for them to do something or just try to pull something off.
Right.
Also, the connection with L. Ron Hubbard is just bizarre. He mentions in the book that L. Ron Hubbard stole one of Parsons' girlfriends from him, and the girl's name actually had the last name of Northrop, which that's people that found in Northrop Grumman. So, you know, through the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which Parsons helped to found, there's all this strange connections with the military-industrial complex.
Yeah.
Too.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
And these kind of things just seem to come together in that 1 year.
Yeah.
It's strange. There's a lot of synchronicity.
It's wild to think about.
I think it's almost time to get Go Ridley back on.
He can clear all this up for us.
So, Luke wanted to mention a YouTube video that we watched tonight.
Yeah.
And what was that called, Luke?
It was called Paranormal Battle.
Paranormal Battle!
Paranormal Battle. With Mirage and Shay.
That's right.
And, yeah.
These girls are going to totally revolutionize the field of the paranormal.
Yeah.
So everybody needs to type in Paranormal Battle on YouTube and give it a listen.
I think it's pretty
watch rather.
I think it's pretty obvious that they're friends of ours.
Yeah.
So
we're gonna have them on the show, man.
Yeah.
They're gonna channel Bernie Mac and Abraham Lincoln for us.
You can hear the kind of skepticism in me and Adam's voice too. I mean, it's not. It's pretty.
I don't know what you're talking about.
It's pretty apparent. But you know what?
Feast or out, brother.
Yeah.
That's the point of this show. We explore different kinds of beliefs and
Exactly. Yeah. These girls, they wholeheartedly believe in what they're doing, it seems like. And
apparently so.
At least they have an open mind and the interest to try to do something with it, you know.
I gotta applaud them for that. Well, unless there's anything else you want to add, I think we're calling it a night.
Alrighty.
Next week we have Tim Kilkenny. He is one of the co-hosts of Revelations Radio News. And we had his co-host Andrew Hoffman on back in, I believe, September of last year, which was a really good interview. I believe that's like episode 12, I think. I may be getting my episodes mixed up. But Tim will be on. We're going to talk about just like kind of what's going on in the world. Talk about his, you know, his experiences, his life, and how he started it. The Revelations Radio News, which is one of my favorite podcasts. So, without further ado, I think we'll call it a night, sir.
Right on.
All right. Join us next week on
Conspiranormal.